Will you please join me in this serenity prayer? God,
grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Tonight, our 40-minute speaker is Ben from Fullerton. Please welcome Ben.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Ben Favre. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Kathleen for asking me to come out. She called me on, I think it was either a Saturday or Sunday morning. And we're in escrow right now, closing on, trying to buy a house. And our original close day was for today. And she asked me to do it today. And I thought, you know, if it all falls through, or we have to extend it, I want to do something like this to take my mind off of it. But it's extended, so it will, and hopefully it closes next Tuesday. But it's in God's hands. My sobriety date is January 12th of 2001. My sponsor is a gentleman named by the name of Larry T. And my home group is the Bellflower Big Book Group. Yesterday was a tough day, and today was like an amazing day. We just found out that the baby that we're having is going to be a girl, and no now whether I need to start buying tutus or rather than baseball gloves, but I'm just really excited about it. My mom had me when she was 16 years old. As our book describes, she was either a moderate drinker or a heavy drinker. And she was drinking as often as she possibly could and doing what she wanted to do. And when she had me, as our book describes, that type of drinker can easily find themselves to stop or moderate. And that's exactly what she did. She's drinks on occasion now. It's no big deal for her. And, she's not the kind of drinker, the alcoholic that I am. And she found God and started going to church, and that's what's worked for her. I was born in Tacoma, Washington. I always felt really uncomfortable. I hated my name. I don't know what it was, but I could walk into a room and your heads, well, you are all staring at me now, but I could be walking in the back and everybody's faced this way and feel like everyone's staring at me. And, I just felt really uncomfortable everywhere I was. And I hated my name. I thought Ben was a wussy's name. It seemed to me that everybody who was cooler than I was named Mike. And, so we play cops and robbers or cowboys and Indians, just call me Mike, And, they would call me Mike for a little while. When I was about 7 years old, my parents had another son and, they named him Mike. And, I always hated that little bastard. And, it made me feel even more uncomfortable. As a kid, it was like, I would see, if I could just get that hat, everything would be okay, and I would get that hat, I'd put that hat on, and fill up that hole for a little while, that hole would open up again, and I would think, if I get that shirt, then everything would be okay. I would get that shirt, I'd fill up that hole for a little while, and then a hole would open up again, and I'm starting this vicious cycle of trying to find something outside myself to make me feel better on the inside, and I just continue to do that throughout my life, and when I was about 10 years old, my stepfather had a job opportunity to move down to California, and being born and raised in Washington, it was, you think California, you automatically think Hollywood, I didn't really understand geography at the time, and, so I immediately assumed that, we're going to the movies, and I'm thinking I'm going to be rich and famous, and I'm going to be a guest appearance on The Simpsons. I'm going to be in some commercials. It's going to be great, because everybody in Hollywood is on TV. And my mom had me at 16 years old. I was pretty, she was, dressing me, grunge was really popular in the early 80s. So I'm wearing ripped up jeans and ripped up flannels. And we moved to Huntington Beach, and the grunge scene is really popular in Seattle, where in that area where I'm from, and moved to Huntington Beach, and they think that they're the surf capital of the world. So everyone's wearing Vans and playing Pogs and talking about going surfing. And I have none of this stuff has reached up to Washington yet. And I'm just feeling really uncomfortable. And I look white trash. I started getting into fights. And I'm just uncomfortable all the time. And not that I'm any sort of tough guy. I am getting a little bigger, but it's only because my wife's pregnancy. It has nothing to do with going to the gym, but I just felt really uncomfortable, and I remember we moved again, and I just kind of gave up. I didn't feel like trying anymore, and I wasn't doing much in school, and. I went to another school district, a whole different group of people, and I just started being the class clown and messing around all the time. And I remember from seventh grade into eighth grade, I decided that I wanted to be in leadership. And at the end of the year, it became like the most important thing in the world. I wasn't doing any work whatsoever beforehand, and for some reason, I was able to get in. I'm the type of person, if I really want something, I get it. But once I get it, I have this problem where I don't actually work for it anymore. And when I stop working for it, it goes away. I was quickly kicked out of leadership. I barely graduated junior high. Normally you don't hear that. You normally hear I barely graduated college or I barely graduated high school, but I'm an overachiever when it comes to being a loser. And barely graduated junior high, and I was at my friend's house, summertime, and all my friends have been drinking by this point, and I always knew that drinking was bad. You know, I knew that my real father was an alcoholic, I knew that my grandfather was an alcoholic, and I knew that if I were to drink that I'd probably end up like them, and I didn't want to end up like that. So I always told myself I wasn't going to drink, and I'm at my friend's house, and I don't know what it is, but if you're excited about doing something for me, it makes me excited. And they were excited to get me that drunk that night, and I forgot about all that not drinking stuff, and I decided I was gonna drink this 40 of Mickey's, and we're waiting for these 40s of Mickey's to show up. They show up around 10:50. I have to be home at 11, and I drink this 40 real fast, and all right, get out of here and start skateboarding home, and I just get this comfort. This peace, this feeling like everything is in the right place. And I knew that alcohol was going to be a big part of my life. And I didn't start drinking on a continuous basis right away. It took about 2 weeks. And I was drinking as often as I could. I always told myself, I'm only going to do it at parties. And that never happened. Whenever it was available, I was doing it. Counselor pulled me aside halfway through my freshman year of high school and said that I was going to have to go to an accelerated school to get the credits to graduate on time. I think, all right, I'll get out of here and go to independent studies. And I was excited about that, less responsibility, don't have to wake up in the morning. I'm at my aunt and uncle's house either Thanksgiving or Christmas, I don't recall, but my aunt and uncle are fairly wealthy, and they said, we'll pay for you to go to Mater Dei. And I think that'd be great. I'll go to Mater Dei, I'll get good grades, I'll go to any college I want to, I'll join a sport, things will be great, it'll be great. And I heard Catholic girls were easy, I was like, another plus. But then that second thought is they're going to drug test me. I said, that's all right. I'm gonna go to independent studies and high achiever. I went into independent studies and it was great. I'd go to school for a half hour a week. I'd get these little packets. I would go home and I would drink and smoke weed all day and go back and turn the packets in half done and get A's. It was awesome. And I had it made. There was no problems. I kept everything a secret. I knew if I got into trouble or my mom caught me or whatever, that I was going to have to stop drinking, and I didn't want to have to. So I kept everything really quiet. And I didn't have any problems for a couple of years. You hear a lot of times in Alcoholics Anonymous all these crazy stories. People waking up in India or just all kinds of stuff. And that wasn't my story. I was 13, 14, 15, 16 years old. And I was hanging out in the garage with four or five dudes. And that was what we did, just drank all night. And every once in a while, we'd venture out to a party and stand in a circle. And everybody else would be drinking, having fun, talking to each other. And five of us would be, "How's it going, man? You guys having fun?" Same thing, just different area. Every once in a while, I hung out with the punk rock kids. So we'd I'm going to stay at his house, and he's going to stay at this house, and we'd sleep in the street. And got a perfectly warm bed at home, and I'm on the edge, living on the edge. It's just stupid. But I was having fun, and I didn't have any problems, and I was really enjoying myself, and I felt okay for the first time in my life, and I knew that eventually alcohol would be a problem, but I wasn't willing to admit it to myself for a while, and I'm starting to drink every single day, and I get into this kind of routine, and I think most alcoholics, we get into some sort of routine after a period of time, and my routine was, I wait for my friend Jeff to get out of school, I go over to his house, and we'd get a couple Miller High Lifes, and we would drink these Miller High Lifes and watch Dazed and Confused every day, I remember watching that movie and just thinking, if I could just live like that, if I would have just been like in high school in the 70s, everything would have been great. I grew up in the wrong time. That's the problem. And I'm thinking, if I go back to regular high school, then, I'll join a sport, I'll only drink on the weekends, I'll go to the parties, and it'll be great, And I got these delusions that if I just situate my life in such a way, then everything is going to be all right. And I really wanted to be Matthew McConaughey. I don't know why. I just hang around the pool table and gawk at 18-year-old girls for the rest of my life. Now that I'm 29, it's just kind of gross. But I decided I'm going to go back to regular high school. And that summer, before going back, I was at a friend's house. And I had always stayed away from hard drugs or other drugs other than alcohol and weed. But that night I was, the reason that I stayed away from other things was because I had a friend who took too much acid a couple years before, and he was walking up and down Westminster Boulevard butt naked thinking he had pink spots all over him, and then we didn't see him for about 6 months, so I didn't really want any part of that. But that night I was at my friend's house, and he had some acid. It was 4th of July, and I thought, man, that'd be really cool. And I take this hit of acid, and I didn't think it was working, so I took 30-some-odd shots of various different types of booze. I remember going home, and normally what I would do when I would go home, good night, Mom, go right to bed. For whatever reason, that night I just wanted to chat. I walk in, and, "Hey, Mom, how's it going? It's good to see you." She goes, "Come here, she gets right in my face and she goes, "Blow my face." And I'm like, she goes, "You've been drinking, haven't you?" She takes me back over to my friend's house, and my mom is the type of mom where, you don't bring your friends around, especially the people who I'm hanging around with. And the reason is because she likes to ask questions. And if you're hanging around the type of people I'm hanging around with, they don't know the answers to those questions. So you just keep them away, she brings them over there brings me over there, and she's yelling at all these guys, and "He's never coming over here again." And my good friends are just standing there going, "We don't care. Just get out of here, we left there, and that was basically the beginning of the end. My first sponsor, says that we drink for as long as we can, and then we drink for about 8 months after that, and that's basically what I did. I kept drinking. All that happened really was I started doing worse things in order to get what I needed, and I started keeping worse secrets and doing worse things. That summer I went up to Washington to visit my dad, by this time he's my drinking buddy, and We were drinking one night, and my grandmother had heard that I'd been drinking, and she comes over and she sits me down in her car, and she's crying, and she says, "Ben, I can't." She says, "Ben, you're going to be just like your dad. You're going to be just like your grandfather." And and I'm thinking to myself, you don't understand. This is the only thing that makes me feel okay. And and I don't say any of those things. I just said, "All right, I'll stop. I'm not an idiot." And I got out of the car and kept drinking. And she told my mom. And when I got back home, we had an appointment with a family counselor. And we went to this family counselor. And I don't know what it is, but if you're non-alcoholic, I can convince you it's something they're doing that's making me act this way. And and after about a half hour or so, this counselor looks at me and says, "What is it you need from your mom?" And I said, "Well, she never buys me any clothes." And the counselor looked at my mom and said, "Why don't you go and take him shopping?" And we never went to any more family counseling sessions. And and like I said, I wanted to go back to regular high school, so I, go to a different school, try and change things, different group of people. And I go to this, I go to Westminster, and instead of the other school in Huntington. And and I had been drinking so much that I couldn't go an entire day during the day without drinking. And I would get to school and I had this strong desire to live normally. I had this strong desire to just, be one of these regular, normal kids. And, and I would get to school, I'd go to class, and I just feel like everyone's staring at me. I feel uncomfortable and my skin is crawling, and I would just have to go. I'd have to leave. And after a month or so, I got arrested. I'm going to this youth shelter, and I get out of this youth shelter after a couple weeks, and I tell myself, all right, that's what I needed. I needed to be separated from alcohol for a little while, and now that I haven't had a drink in a couple weeks, that I'll be all right, and I'll be able to stop. And I get out of that place. I go to school the next day, and I'm not going to drink. 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 And I go to my zero period PE class, and I remember telling, I was kind of excited about trying to stay sober, and the coach asked me where I was, and I was, I got arrested for drugs and drinking at school, and he goes, "It was cocaine, wasn't it? You guys make good runners." And I went, no. What I was doing does not make good runners. But I left there, and I remember running into my friend Jeff in the hallway, and he says, "You want to get out of here?" And I go, no, I'm not going to drink anymore. And he goes, "Well, Tim just got a bottle of Jack Daniels and a new bomb." "Well, I can start tomorrow. I'll stop drinking." And that's all it took. And every day after that, for the next couple of months, was, "I'll start tomorrow. I'll start tomorrow. I'll start tomorrow. I cannot do it today, but I can do it tomorrow." And and tomorrow was never coming, and I knew it wasn't coming. And every day I felt even worse inside, and I couldn't handle it anymore. I genuinely wanted to stop drinking, but I didn't know how. And right before Thanksgiving that year, I was coming home for one day, and my mom had been getting the calls that I hadn't been showing up to school again. And I walk into the house, and we're arguing, and something after about 20 minutes, something just kind of broke inside, and I just said, "I can't stop drinking." And she said, "We'll get you some help." And she puts me in this outpatient treatment center. I'm in this outpatient treatment center for a couple of weeks. I'm going to school during the day and going to this place at night and sitting in these groups and going to a couple meetings. And every day I'm trying not to drink. I'm trying not to drink. And at some point I would have to drink. And, I never knew what it was going to be. I might be able to, sometimes I'd be able to make it all day long, and I'd be laying in bed, I'd be tossing and turning, and I can't fall asleep. And, bottle of NyQuil in the medicine cabinet. And then I'd be able to rest. And I started doing other things that I thought would get out of my system quicker. Unfortunately, they didn't. And after 2 weeks, they said my drug alcohol level was higher than when I'd come in. And either I needed to stop or I needed to leave. And I knew I wasn't going to be able to stop, so I left there. I stole some money from my parents. I ran away from home. I'm staying in my friend's shed behind his house. And I'm drinking a fifth of Jack Daniels every day, and I'm just thinking, how did this happen? How did I get here? You know, where had all these dreams, all these things that I wanted, all the things that I thought I was going to have for my life, but I had no idea how I got here. Now I'm just this loser that I had always looked at like a loser. You know, I'm that guy, and I couldn't understand how I'd gotten there, and. After a couple of weeks, I blacked out. I decided apparently that I was going to steal a movie from Hollywood Video, and came to as the buzzers are going off, and I just kind of keep shuffling, and they kind of come outside, and there was no more fight, and they pulled me back inside. They called the police, and the police came to pick me up and took me to the Westminster Police Department. My mom comes to pick me up. It's probably, you know, 1 a.m. by this time, and she puts me in her car, and I haven't seen her for a couple weeks by this point. And she says, "Ben, I can't do this anymore. If you want to live your life like that, you're going to have to do it somewhere else." Every time I hear the phone ring, I think the cops got you. Every time I hear sirens, I think you're dead in the gutter somewhere. You know, and I never wanted to make my mom feel like that. I never wanted to treat her like that. I know what she sacrificed having me at 16 years old. And I had nothing but love and respect for that woman, but I couldn't help but tear her heart out on a daily basis. And what do I do in that situation? You know, so most people would say, "I'm sorry. I was wrong. What can I do to make it up?" You know, I don't do that. I know how much I'm hurting her, and I just laugh in her face. Because I can't look at the problem. I can't look at what I'm doing to you. I can't accept that. Next morning I get into a fist fight with my stepdad. There's a restraining order over Christmas. My mom calls to tell me to come over and have some breakfast with her and open some presents around 9 a.m. on Christmas Day. And I go over to her house and I had these ideas when I'm going over there, just be nice. Just say thank you, have a good conversation, when I'm not drinking, I'm restless, I'm irritable, and I'm discontented, and either she said something I didn't want to hear or I didn't get what I wanted, I started breaking things in her house and pushing her around, and she called the police, and it seemed like the police were there in seconds, and she opens the door, and they just pointed at me, and they said, "Get the hell out of here, kid. You don't belong here anymore." And I left there and I went to this grocery store and I stole two tall boys and Mickey's, and I just wanted to recapture that first drink. I just wanted to take that sigh of relief and say that everything was going to be okay. I just wanted to feel like everything was in the right place. And for whatever reason, it didn't do what I needed it to do that night, that day. And I stayed at that bottom for another couple of weeks, and Social services stepped in and said that I was going to have to go to an inpatient place, or they were going to take me away. And my parents said, "We'll give it one last chance." And I got, like I mentioned earlier, I got sober on January 12th of 2001. And the night before I got sober wasn't anything spectacular, wasn't anything crazy. There wasn't any major bottom. It was just like the couple nights before that. I had gotten out of this youth shelter, and I remember, you know, I tell my mom, I'm leaving. I'm going to go say goodbye to my friends since I'm not going to see them for a while. And she says, "Okay," surprisingly. And later on, just actually recently, I asked her, you know, "Why did you say okay?" And she said, "But I knew that if I said no, that you were going to leave anyways, and you probably wouldn't come back. And if I said yes or okay, that you were going to leave, and hopefully you would come back." And for whatever reason, I went back that night, and I woke up the next morning. It was January 12th, 2001, and that's my sobriety date. And I've been sober since that day. I've not taken a drink or any other mind-altering substance since the day before. And I can't believe where I am today. If I were new and I were listening to someone who looked like me, I wouldn't think that I had ever done the things that I had done. And that's only because of Alcoholics Anonymous and being busy in it for 12 years. But anyways, I started going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I started identifying and they started telling me to get a sponsor and, After about a month and a half, I asked this guy, and I wasn't able to find one for whatever reason. I actually asked a couple, and one guy said, you know, I don't have enough time, and the other guy said, I just got my kids back, and why don't you ask him? And I just said, screw it, and I stopped asking people. And talking to this lady, Patty, one day, and Patty says, why don't you ask this guy right here? And this guy was leaving, and I walk outside, and I walk up to him. I said, hey, would you be my sponsor? And he didn't give me one of these lines. Why don't you meet me here? Why don't you call me for the next couple of weeks, and we'll see how it works out. Why don't you read this and get back to me? You know, he said, are you willing to go to any length for victory over alcohol? And I was tired of the way I was feeling. I was tired of the way I was living. And I said, I'll do whatever you want me to do. You know, and he had something in his eyes. He had something I knew I didn't have. And I had this feeling like he was going to show me how to get it. And I started going through that book with that guy. And I'd read the book before talking to him. And I'm thinking, how can I relate to this stockbroker from the 1920s? You know, I'm 16 and it was 2001. What the hell is a ticker anyways? You know, I remember reading that XYZ minus one. What does that even mean? That's really bad. But I had no idea what that meant. And big deal, you know. He started taking me through that book and having me identify. And he just stopped every once in a while and asked me questions. And I realized that I related to Bill more than I could have fathomed on my own. No, I wasn't stealing from my wife's purse. I was stealing from my mom's purse. No, I wasn't golfing. I was a skateboarder and a punk rock kid. No, I wasn't not taking that job opportunity. I was not taking that opportunity to go to a better school. You know, I had so many similarities to Bill. And I realized that maybe I was an alcoholic, and I became even more willing to do what he suggested. And I got kicked out of that treatment center after about 5 months or four and a half months. And again, I'm in this fork in the road. I'm going to either go to this treatment center or I'm going to go to Arizona until I'm 18, or I'm going to go into sober living. And my sponsor and this lady in that treatment center convinced my parents to put me in a sober living and signed me over to the house manager there. I just got busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember all these people just started, they would show up and pick me up and take me, you know, I was staying in Orange. These guys would drive from South Orange County to Orange, back to South Orange County to take me to a meeting, back to Orange, and then back to their house, you know, I had all these people just picking me up all the time, and it was because I genuinely wanted what they had. And I started to really enjoy Alcoholics Anonymous and started getting commitments in the meetings and we kept going through the steps and I'd heard these goofy things and some of the participation meetings that I was going to, and you know, one of those things was, you know, this guy had worked on the seventh step. I had already done the seventh step. I didn't realize that I was clearly delusional. And we did the fifth, and then I went in my room and I did the sixth and the seventh, and I thought there was other stuff we were going to do. You know, I wanted him to do something to me. But this guy started talking about how he put all these character defects in a hat and he'd pull one of them out and work on it for the day. And I remember calling my sponsor this, you know, are we gonna work on my character defects? And he goes, if you were to work on your character defects, you know, let's say lust. How about you work on lust for the rest of the day? Just, you know, try not to act in lust. You know, just think about, you know, not being lustful all day. And he goes, by the end of the day, you'd be humping the ground. You just leave that to God. You know, let him deal with it and try and help somebody else. I go, okay. One of these other, you know, we got to the eighth and the ninth step. And then one of these other things that I had heard was that, you know, that I had harmed myself the most and needed to make amends to me. So I put myself on the top of that list and we're going over the eighth step and I read my name and how I had harmed myself. And he goes, wait, what the hell are you even doing on the list? I go, well, I hurt me the most. He goes, why don't you put your mom and some other people up there, and we'll put you just at the bottom. After you make amends to the rest of these people, if you want to make amends to yourself, go right ahead. He had me write this letter to my mom, and I remember I wrote this letter, and it goes, all right, now go over to her house, sit her down, and read the letter to her, and don't say anything that's not on the letter. Just read the letter and let her talk. And I don't want you to screw this thing up. And so here I am, and I sit down with her, and at the end it said something to the effect of, if there's anything I can do to make these things right, please just let me know. And she said that she had seen a change in me in that 5 months or 6 months, and just to keep doing Alcoholics Anonymous to the best of my ability. And that's exactly what I've done. I've not always done it perfectly. I've made plenty of mistakes, but I've done Alcoholics Anonymous to the best of my ability. And I made a couple more amends, and I was amazed before I was halfway through and didn't make any more amends for another couple of years. I guess I had some other things to learn. And when I was about a year and a half sober or so, I'm sitting at meetings and I'm feeling uncomfortable, and I got this thing in the back of my head saying that I'm just a little bit different. You know, maybe it was a phase, maybe it was this, maybe, you know, you've grown out of it, maybe you stayed sober long enough and now you're okay. And my alcoholism is messing with me. And I think we all come in with something like that, you know, just saying we're just a little bit different. And I'm sitting in this meeting, and this guy sits next to me, and he says, aren't you a little too young to be here? I said, you don't know me, you son of a bitch. I didn't really say that. I probably said something really witty, like, no, you know. But I went home that night, and I'm going to find something to throw in his face. So I grabbed that book and I'm going through there, and got my highlighter out, you know, I'm going to find it. And it's either in chapter 2 or 3, and it starts talking about young people, and it says, there are those of us who only drank for a few years that were in the same position as those of us who drank for 20 years. And I, you know, got the highlighter. Here it is. This is it. And I keep underlining, and this is particularly true of the woman alcoholic. And won't be bringing that one up anytime soon. But for whatever reason, that was all I needed. There was no more debate. There was nothing in the back of my head saying maybe I was just a little bit different. I knew that I was an alcoholic without a shadow of a doubt. And when I didn't make any more amends for a couple of years. And when I was about 2.5 years sober, I was at this retreat, and this guy Keon cornered me. And Keon was this type of guy where, you know, you kind of keep him away. You don't want to get him too close, but you love hearing him share, because you know every time he would share, you take something from him. You know, you feel good. But if you talk to him, he's going to ask you about what you're doing. So, you know, you just kind of keep him a little ways back. But he corners me that weekend, and he goes, how you doing? And all this crap just starts spewing out. And he goes, you know, once I started making financial amends, my financial life got better. And once I started making relationship amends, my relationships got better. And I want to be rich, and I want everyone to love me. So I went out and I made 30 amends that week. And I couldn't afford to pay these people back, or I couldn't find them the week before, but all of a sudden they all appeared. And I got fired up about it. I got all these lists, you know, I got lists of liquor stores, grocery stores, 7-Elevens, you know, old friends, police officers, all these things. And I'm working each of them one day at a time. I'm working the 7-Elevens one day. And, you know, I'd stolen, most of it, what I had done was pretty petty. I'm not any time a big convict. I just steal for the day, you know, a couple things here and there. But I walk into these stores and pay them back for the cigarettes and booze that I had stolen. And, you know, I walk into the line. There's 4 or 5 7-Elevens in Westminster, on Westminster Boulevard. And I walk into this last one, and all of them had gone really well. All said, thank you. Man, I've never had anybody do this before. That's so awesome. Thank you so much. So I'm feeling pretty good about it. You know, this last one, I had stolen 2 packs of cigarettes. No big deal. This is going to be easy. And walk in and wait for the line to die down and walk up there. I got $10 in my hand, and I say, in order for me to stay sober, I need to make every wrong I made right. And a little over 2.5 years ago, I stole 2 packs of cigarettes. And in order for me to stay sober, I need to pay you back. Apparently there was a language barrier. And he said, you want 2 packs of cigarettes? No, I need to pay you back. I stole 2 packs of cigarettes. You stole from my store? You get out of here. So, want your money. And, you know, I'm a little freaked out, and I don't know what to do. And I look behind me, and this guy's standing there, and he goes, "Don't worry about it. You did your part." I was like, "Holy crap, you bastards are everywhere." I left there, and I got in my little car, and I'm driving home, and I don't know what it was, maybe the good amends, or that amends that didn't go quite the way I thought it was going to, or the sun hitting me in the eyes just the right way, but I got this feeling like everything was in the right place. I got this feeling like everything was going to be okay, and I knew that it was a direct result of doing what you guys told me to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I caught fire for AA, and I've been on fire ever since. Not that I haven't made any mistakes. I'm a human being, and the difference between whether I stay sober or drink, my friend Diana says this is if I continue to defend those mistakes, you know. But I'm willing to continue. I've been fortunately willing to continue to make those mistakes, right? And I was working at this job. I'm the oldest of seven. I don't mention them until now because I had always wanted to be an only child. But a couple of years ago, maybe 6-7 years ago, I was working at this job in Huntington Beach. It was about 5 minutes from my parents' house, and I would go over to their house every day and get a free lunch. And you know, my youngest brother at the time was, I think, was 3 years old. And one day he comes up to me, he grabs this book, and he slaps it on my lap and says, "Read." And "All right, you little bastard." And I sat on my lap and I read this book to him. And I started looking forward to doing that. And I keep doing that. And after a couple months, I'm starting to look forward to it. And I've got to get over there, read to that little kid. And one day I go over there, I read to him, and I'm leaving just like I usually do. And he runs up to the door and he grabs the lock and he locks it and he grabs my leg and he says, "You can't leave. You can't leave." And I'm standing directly in front of that door where I was told to leave because I didn't belong there anymore a few years before that. And it was only because of Alcoholics Anonymous and doing the things that you guys suggested that made me belong there. Doing those little things, just nothing special, not changing the world, not there's no Make-A-Wish program coming out of here. You know, I was just thinking about this little kid for a couple minutes a day, and I got to experience something I never thought I would have been able to experience. And I had that feeling once again, like everything was in the right place, and I've been chasing it ever since. And I got married a little over a year ago to someone I once hated, but we have an awesome relationship, and it's not, there's not one lopsided, you know, it's not lopsided, you know, we both make an effort to show love and affection towards one another, you know, and because of that we have a good relationship. If it was lopsided in any way, we wouldn't have the relationship that we have. Like I mentioned earlier, I just found out recently that I'm going to be a father, and that brings a world of emotions. You know, am I going to be the father that my father was? Am I going to be like my grandfather? All I have is what the things that I modeled after. Fortunately, being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's men in these rooms that I look up to that have been great fathers. And I know that I'm going to be a good father and a good husband if I continue to take their suggestions. And that's what I continue to try and do. And I can't tell you how grateful I am for my life. There was a guy when I was new, he would always share, or I would always walk up to him and I would say, "How you doing, Chuck?" And he would say, "Better than I deserve." And I go, "Okay, you know, all right." I kept doing that, and "How you doing, Chuck?" And he would ask me how I'm doing. "Well, not as good as I deserve," you know. On the contrary, I told my sponsor this one time, and he goes, "You know, I don't want to be anywhere near you when you get what you deserve." But But I go up to this guy, Chuck, one time, and I go, "What do you mean by that? What do you mean? And he says, "For everything, every bad thing I've done, mistake I've made, person I've hurt, my life is better than I deserve." And I truly believe that for myself today. And I only have you to thank for it. Thank you.